Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is MPB News.
Hi, this is Karen Brown. Thanks for checking out the Mississippi Edition podcast. If you like what you hear, click subscribe, hit like, or leave us a comment if your app has that feature. Then find other MPB podcasts by searching MPB Think Radio on your favorite podcasting platform. Thanks. Good morning. It's 8:30 on Tuesday, March 9th. I'm Karen Brown, and this is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, officials in the city of Jackson say the current water crisis is nearing an end, but certain underlying issues still need to be reconciled. Then, as the state approaches the one-year anniversary of its first case of COVID-19, health officials reflect on the year that was. Plus, as the nation recognizes National Women's Month, advocates in Mississippi say more must be done to support low-income single mothers. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. Water restoration in Jackson is nearly complete after more than 3 weeks of outages. Public Works Director Charles Williams says most residents should have access to running water, but pressure remains an issue. The entire city is still under a boil water advisory.
As we reach within the fourth week of the water crisis, I believe that we have a majority of our residents who have had their water restored. I believe that the remaining residents that are lacking right now, it's not so much from a lack of water, but more so from low water pressure. And that is still in certain areas in South Jackson. Now, I do want to note that our system was not normal prior to the event. And when I say normal, that means that we have a number of water main breaks throughout the system that disrupt water to our customers. And then secondly, we also had issues at the plant that were evident through an inspection by the EPA about a year ago. So we have been working to address those particular issues, but the winter storm exposed a lot of those deficiencies that were noted in that report. What I do want to say is that when we talk about normal, I'm not sure that we will get back to normal. That is why we are requesting funding from additional resources in order to help us address that. But right now, we feel that the system is more stable now, right now. We are seeing gains in our tanks. We've been maintaining around 85 PSI. We should go up a little higher later today. And we anticipate a full recovery within the system probably by the end of the week. You know, this brought to light a lot of issues that have been plaguing the city for some time. And in order for us to fully address it, that's why we've been asking for funding. So I'm going to work extremely hard with the mayor as we touch on different areas and resources in order to help that be achieved. And I look forward to the progress that we'll be making in the future. Thank you.
The immediate cause of the water issues in Jackson was last month's winter storm, but the underlying complications have been decades in the making. Mayor Chokwayan Tarlamumba says the city is working on securing aid from the state and federal level.
I'm optimistic. We will continue to voice our concerns and our needs, and we will talk to all necessary parties. Right now, we're gonna move forward and press forward with optimism that will be heard. Now, in terms of the question of routine maintenance, that is correct. But the question then becomes, why haven't we been able to effectuate the routine maintenance that is needed? And that comes down to a matter of resources. We have talked exhaustively about the limitation of city budgets, the aging infrastructure, the increased effect of things like hotter summers, colder winters, and more rain, and the effect that has on our infrastructure. And so I think that it is a measure of the responsibility not only of cities, but it is a reflection of the responsibility of state leadership and state resources and federal resources. Jackson, unfortunately, is not an outlier. This is a circumstance that we see repeated far too often across the state and across the country.
Lumumba has been front and center during the weeks of the water crisis, calling for state leadership to recognize the need for long-term investment in the state's largest city.
The formation of government is an operation of protecting the people. That is the very impetus by which we have government. And so providing resources to people who have been stretched in the midst of this pandemic, people who have been harmed in many ways, is not a handout, as it is necessary support that we should be able to expect from our state and federal leadership. I want to be clear that the city of Jackson not only needs infrastructure support, we also need COVID support in the midst of this pandemic like every other city in the country. And so I don't want to mix the two. I don't want to confuse the two. I don't want to be cheated in our effort to get the support that we need. And so that is important.
Lumumba says he plans to meet with Governor Tate Reeves. He says he wants to find a way to sincerely resolve the city's infrastructure problems, but rejects any plans that include ceding city assets like the Jackson Evers Airport.
I do have a scheduled meeting where we're going to sit down with one another again. And so I'd like to leave that the opportunity for growth in our discussions to take place. But as I have stated before, obviously I don't favor that position. The city of Jackson should not need to be extorted in any way in order to get the resources we justly deserve. Just to give by way of example, there are many capital cities around the country that states recognize the great sacrifice that a capital city takes on. Not only in Jackson's instance, where we are the largest population by a factor of three, which means that we contribute the lion's share of state taxes to the state of Mississippi, but also we confront the issue that so much of our property stock is state property that is untaxable and leaving it unavailable for us to make the profit that we would make if private business or an individual were to have ownership. And so many states pay city capitals payment in lieu of taxes, recognizing not only that sacrifice, but in the city of Jackson's instance, we don't even get water bills from the state, though we provide water to them. And so as we talk about a water crisis, that is a significant note to make that, if we just got the money for what we provide you, then maybe we might be in a more sufficient place. And so I look forward to those conversations. I think that that sincere people can have sincere disagreements. But one of the main points of dialogue and diplomacy is coming to the table in a sincere way in order to help the people in which we serve.
Coming up, as the state approaches the one-year anniversary of its first case of COVID-19, health officials reflect on the year that was. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Hi, I'm Ryder Taff, portfolio manager at New Perspectives, a fee-only financial advisory and co-host of Money Talks. Each week, we take your personal finance questions and tell you about a money topic we hope you find helpful. Money Talks can be heard Tuesdays at 9 a.m. on MPB Think Radio. Podcasts can be found on our website, money.mpbonline.org, or on your smart device's podcasting platform.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Karen Brown. Nearly 500,000 Mississippians have received their first dose of a coronavirus vaccine. The milestone comes nearly 1 year after the first case of COVID-19 was identified in Mississippi. The state's health officials are reflecting on the year that was as the state nears the anniversary date of March 11th. Health Officer Dr. Thomas Dobbs and state epidemiologist Dr. Paul Byers recall it was mid-January when the Department of Health realized potential severity of the coronavirus.
Probably mid-January, Dr. Byers walked in my office and said, "Hey, look at this." And he showed some data. He said, "I think this is the big one. I think this is going to be the big pandemic. I just got to give you kudos, Paul. You recognize the seriousness of it. And it had the pieces involved that were really going to make it explosive. And you were right." In a way, it's not how we expected, because when we looked at our modeling based on transmission, but was mostly based on flu, we had predicted a mortality of about 150 to 200,000 Americans who would have died. But we made some, within that planning, there were some assumptions that didn't turn out to be true. And that was this over-politicization of non-pharmaceutical interventions, which was not in the playbook, right? So we've made some errors as a country by not having a steady approach to our preventive measures. And so I hope that we've learned our lesson after a couple of massive failures to just go slowly, go carefully as we are getting the upper hand with vaccination.
And you know, I think one of the biggest things for us looking at it from an epidemiological standpoint is just how many unknowns there were. You know, we could look at what was going on in other countries, and it was obvious at that point that there was pretty easy transmission and that it was affecting the vulnerable populations. I think we probably could have predicted that it was going to have a significant impact on those individuals with chronic underlying medical problems and individuals who are older and in long-term care residents. I think that it's just rolled out. You know, I think if I could be honest of where we were in January, I'm going to be honest that I didn't think we'd be sitting here another year later still talking about this. It has been a real adventure. I think one of the big things that we hadn't considered until later because of sort of some of the messages that we got was the use of masks and ultimately what a value the mask would be in preventing transmission. And that's one of the big lessons for me anyway.
As the state prepared for the potential pandemic, early mitigation guidance from federal leadership was disjointed. Dr. Dobbs says there's a long-existing neglect of public health systems in the United States.
Not surprised at all. Not surprised at all, right? So in the United States of America, we have chronically underfunded, underinvested, and undermined our public health systems. We will learn a lesson, throw a bunch of money at it, and forget, right? So we set up all these, you know, all these efforts after Katrina in Mississippi and parts of the country, after 9/11, after Pan Flu, after Ebola, right? And so there's always money to chase the problem that was ahead of us. I mean, behind us, not the one that's ahead of us. This is something that we've been really pushing on for a long time. We need steady investment, right? We have learned this lesson over and over again. If you can fund public health to a point where it can be ever ready, we'll be in a lot better situation. There's no doubt about it. So I'll say we're not surprised. Even the national stockpile has its own sort of history, right? It was undermined and underfunded just some years prior to the pandemic, right? So we knew it wasn't going to be as strong as it should have been. So that's one thing. One thing I do want to say is I just do want to reinforce the importance of public health and public health authorities. We've been very fortunate in Mississippi to have good relationships with the governor and the speaker and lieutenant governor. They've all been very supportive. But other states don't have that same support, or states have learned the wrong lesson. Ironically, they're trying to undermine the authorities of public health rather than support them. So I hope we don't actually go the wrong direction by undermining public health because they were underfunded to begin with.
For state epidemiologist Dr. Paul Byers, the now year-long fight against the spread of the deadly virus took its toll professionally and personally.
Certainly, it's affected us and myself on a day-to-day basis, just like it's affected the rest of Mississippi and the sacrifices that everyday Mississippians are making as well is, you know, limiting those interactions. A lot of times, not seeing family, vulnerable family for quite some time, you know, reducing the activities down to just being at the house, and certainly it's changed a lot of things in that way, and it'll be interesting to see how those changes unfold in the long run, but it has been an honor to be able to work in this position and do the work that we do every day. If there's anything that's been the most heartbreaking has been the deaths, and the deaths have been difficult, and we're at over 6,000, well over 6,000 now, I believe at over 6,800, and those do weigh heavily.
Health officials say many indicators of high virus transmission are on the decline, such as test positivity, virus-related hospitalizations, and deaths. They're also encouraged by the community's response to vaccine availability. Dr. Dobbs says they continue to explore ways to expand eligibility.
We are always trying to fine-tune availability with eligibility, right, so that we're getting the most bang for our buck. And I think if you consider last week, we received around 120,000, well, about 130,000 doses, and we gave 132,000 doses. We're running it pretty tight, right? So we're getting vaccine out there. One of the things that's very important to be considerate of is there are geographic variabilities. That's very clear. We try to address that as best we can by how we share with partners. But also, we don't want to make it more difficult for people who are most vulnerable, 65 and older, maybe people who are not as internet savvy, maybe people who are facing health disparities. So we want to make sure that we get as many people opportunities as we can. In Mississippi, we have a very broad eligibility compared to other states. So, you know, please think about that. If we look at where other places are, we are looking at everybody 50 and older, anybody with chronic medical conditions, teachers, K-12, and younger kids, preschool and child care, first responders, police, fire, healthcare. And that's a significant majority of the population of the state of Mississippi.
MPB News will be reflecting on the one-year anniversary of the pandemic more this week. On Thursday, in place of Mississippi Edition, MPB News, in collaboration with partner stations in Alabama and Louisiana, will present A Year Like No Other, COVID-19 in the Gulf States. Coming up, as the nation recognizes National Women's Month, advocates in Mississippi say more must be done to support low-income single mothers. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Hi, I'm Dr. Susan Buttress, host of Southern Remedies, Relatively Speaking, a show that explores issues that relate to you and your family, from mental health obstacles and family interactions to handling life's disruptions. Whatever it is, we're here to help. Find out what we're all about and subscribe to the podcast by using any podcast app or by downloading our MPB Public Media app.
This podcast is a local production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting and depends on the support of listeners like you. If you can, please donate today at mpbonline.org. And thanks.
This is Mississippi Edition. I'm Karen Brown. National Women's History Month is a time to commemorate and celebrate the vital role of women in American history. It's also a time to assess socioeconomic progress of women in a sustained fight for financial equality. Advocates say women in Mississippi are making gains, but many are finding it hard to make ends meet financially. Cassandra Welchlin is with the Mississippi Black Women's Roundtable. She tells our Desiree Frazier, Mississippi's women are bearing a tremendous load in the marketplace, but still lack economic security.
This is a very interesting time that we're living in. And for me, given the work that we're doing at the Mississippi Black Women's Roundtable, and that's just as a Black woman, I think about the Black women that we are advocating with and for on behalf of their economic security. You know, we're in the midst of a pandemic, and just in the last several, you know, months, with the racial injustice that occurred, you know, with all the protests that happened. So for me, I'm thinking mostly about Black women and girls and our economic security, and how also we have, you know, been a part of the social political movements in this country to shift power. And so I'm thinking about Black women and our strength and our power, but also the economic security that we still are fighting for to level the playing field.
How are we doing overall? Are we making any gains? Are women making gains?
Women are making gains in the sense that, you know, we are We're always, you know, we are the backbones of our families and the backbones of our communities and always have been, you know, particularly for Black women. We are caregivers. We, you know, we make so many sacrifices for our families. And yet, you know, when we look at, you know, the economic security of our households, we still have a long way to go, particularly, you know, in the state of Mississippi, where Black women are still making 56 cents on the dollar to that of a white male. We have a long ways to go, particularly, you know, given health care, when you still got a little bit over 20,000 Black women that still don't have access to health care. There's a ways to go, and our poverty rate is still very high. And so there is much work that is needed and that's needed to be done in the state of Mississippi and in this country. But yet we still show up. We're still the essential workers. We you know, even in COVID, you know, we are the COVID impacted our communities, you know, so much. We are the essential workers, you know, in Mississippi, you know, we're half the workforce, you know, women are in 2/3 of the minimum wage earners, but we know where poverty is situated in is that's in those single family headed households by Black moms. And so there's still much work to be done when it comes to our economic security, but yet we keep doing it. We keep doing more with less, because we have to.
Do you feel like the powers that be in the state hear you, the state legislators, the governor, the lieutenant governor, the House speaker, the members?
We are building a base and have built a base to where they have to hear us. We have built an infrastructure to where we are knocking on their doors and saying to them, because there's so much that we could be there's so much the state leaders definitely can be doing, but it's going to continue to take our women saying to them, we want equal pay for equal work. We need childcare. We need access to health care. And so that is growing. Is it enough? No, it's not. Are they hearing us all the way? They're hearing, but we're going to continue to knock louder and louder until they write laws that really impact our households. And so there's still much work to be done on that end, but we are doing the work and we are making our voices heard at the policy table.
Are there any bills that speak to what is important to you still alive in the legislature now?
Yes, there are. You know, we have the Medicaid technical bill is still alive, and inside that bill, there are provisions for Medicaid eligibility for moms to have Medicaid 12 months postpartum. That's really incredible and really important, given we know the maternal mortality rate in Mississippi among Black women. That bill will really help give safety and give the necessary medical attention and services that Black women and women who are on Medicaid need in order so they can be healthy. We know those critical moments after having a baby is so important. You still need to have care. And so that bill and those provisions inside of that bill will really help do that. So that bill is so critical and important. There's a domestic violence bill that's still out there. We want to give support to that. And, you know, the dignity bill for women who are incarcerated. That bill is so important that, you know, moms are able to have time, bonding time with their babies, that their babies are not just stripped away from them when they give birth, but they can have their babies with them for 3 days. And also they can get, you know, sanitary napkins, more sanitary napkins, you know, during their menstrual cycle. So those things are really important to the health, to the well-being, and to the mental health of women. It doesn't matter if you're incarcerated or you're not. We're still women. We still have dignity. I mean, that is our human right to live a life of freedom, live a life of dignity. And so we want healthy moms, healthy babies, and we want to have healthy communities. Women We support our communities. We are the backbone of our communities. And so these kinds of legislation will help support the safety, the and the well-being and the economic security of our families.
Cassandra Welchlin with the Black Women's Roundtable, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. Thanks for listening to the Mississippi Edition podcast from MPB News and MPB Think Radio. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already, and if your app lets you, leave a comment or review. We really do appreciate it. Remember, you can always get in touch with MPB News on Facebook and Twitter, and fresh episodes of the podcast are posted every weekday morning. I'm Karen Brown. Thanks for listening. This is Mississippi Edition from MPB Think Radio.